too many of us read about West Africa and our images are dominated by the corrupt few, the thugs, the Congolese dictator. And I just get so angry with that, because the reality is those people don't reflect the human quality in this part of the world. And I wanted to wrestle it back, say, no, you with the guns, you don't keep this. That's the purest human endeavor, survival. If you're lucky enough to be able to go beyond that and grow and develop, then well done, marvelous. But don't ever presume that everyone on the planet is at that same stage. And that's probably my most fundamental lesson that I took.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure. This is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
For many years, Sierra Leone and Liberia have been too dangerous to travel through. They have been places of terrible violence and associated with child soldiers and prisoner mutilations and blood diamonds. These were kind of the headlines that were read about. With their wars officially over, however, Tim Butcher set out on a journey across both countries. And in this episode, he remembers this journey. It is his second appearance on Unfolding Maps. In episode 13, we talked about his book Blood River and his explorations through Congo. Back then, he followed the historic tracks of Henry Morton Stanley. This time, Tim followed the trail blazed by Graham Greene, the famous writer, who was in Sierra Leone and Liberia in 1935 and wrote a book about it, which is now a travel classic. It's called Journey Without Maps. However, Greene back then took 26 porters with him and a case of scotch and hammocks in which he and his cousin Barbara were carried. Tim, on the other hand, walked every blistering inch of the journey by himself, and he did that in order to gain an extraordinary ground-level view of this troubled and overlooked region. And eventually, he also wrote a book about it, and it's really, really great. It's called Chasing the Devil, The Search for Africa's Fighting Spirit. In this conversation, we talk about what kind of devil it actually was that he chased over there and whether he has found the fighting spirit of Africa in these two war-torn countries. Enjoy our conversation. Hi, Tim. Welcome back to Unfolding Maps. I'm really pleased to have you once again.
It's excellent to be back. It's great to be back on Unfolding Maps. Thank you for having me.
In 2009, 5 years after your journey through Congo, which we discussed in our last conversation, you set off on another pretty adventurous trip. On foot through Africa's killing fields, you went to West Africa, specifically to Sierra Leone and Liberia, or Liberia. What was the purpose of that trip? Which questions did you start your journey with?
Well, again, it was a weave of different streams and different reasons that came together. And I think I probably used that language of different, flows of water, little streams gathering to make a forceful river. Why did I want to go there? I wanted to go there because I'm curious. West Africa, a little bit off the map, a little bit distant. I'm also drawn there because as a journalist, I had covered both Sierra Leone and Liberia and frankly been rather terrified in both. I'd been very discombobulated, funny English word. It basically means lost. I mean, confused. And I had been, I went to Liberia. I couldn't make head or tail of the place. There was no sort of meaningful conflict going on. It was just near anarchy. You had not even a despot, like a leader, because the despots, occasionally you see them on the television. But, Charles Taylor was this sort of mysterious figure. No one ever saw him. He was sort of ghosted around in a vehicle. Sometimes the vehicle was seen with tinted windows. No one knew if anyone was behind the tinted windows or not. That added to the kind of mystery. And the war kind of dragged on there. UN were involved. It was complicated. But it was just downright terrifying. Sierra Leone at times equally terrifying. And I'd been there at a time when friends had been killed, journalists, colleagues, friends. They're with me one night and the next night they're not. And it makes you ask questions about yourself. What are you doing? Why are you doing it? And I had waited for a peaceful time for when Charles Taylor wasn't in power anymore, for example. Charles Taylor had actually taken a death threat out on me. I don't take that too personally. He used to do it to a lot of journalists. So that had added to it. So Taylor had to be out of the equation. I had to wait till 2009.
He was Charles Taylor, just for our listeners, he was the president and a former warlord, right? And today he's in prison in, I think, the UK.
He is currently in prison in the UK, but interestingly enough, he's got form. He was also jailed in America for fraud and escaped from a prison. I mean, sort of low-level financial fraud before he ends up in West Africa. And, you know, he's like a Hollywood villain. I mean, you know, absolute no morality, will take weapons from wherever, has no ideological stand or principles. He's just in it for what he could take. And he raided the country famously on Christmas Eve, 1989, and came from Ivory Coast. And, you know, if you did a standard history, it would kind of lose you on page three, frankly, because it's coup and counter-coup and rebel. But what's so interesting for me is that you have a history there. You have an amazingly rich and complicated history in Liberia of, there's that word there. You hear it. Liberty, right? Liberty. I mean, you know, you're speaking to me from the United States, the land of liberty, the Statue of Liberty. The capital of Liberia is named after a US president, Monroe. Monrovia is the name of the capital. And it was because freed African-American slaves were sent back to Africa after the travails and the horrors of the 18th century and the 19th century in America. And something went wrong. Something got twisted there, because those freed slaves from who'd had an experience in America, in, as it were, the New World, went back to the Old World. And guess what they did? They started to slave, to be the slave sellers, to be the slave profiteers. It's a very strange sort of moral twist. And of course, you could perhaps think, well, hold on, they've been sent back to a part of Africa which wasn't their original home. They've been dropped there. Yes, but then they found in their hearts the same cruelty that white slavers did elsewhere. And why is this important? Well, in the 1930s, it was very important. The League of Nations, recently founded in 1918, 1919, one of its first ever jobs was to investigate slavery going on in Africa. And I'm always inspired by those who've gone before. And there is one final stream to this story. One of my favorite writers, an English man of letters, perhaps the greatest novelist that Britain produced in the 20th century, Graham Greene, a versatile man who could write nonfiction as well as fiction, who could write poetry as well as film scripts, who could argue a piece in a newspaper, a sort of piece of opinion in a newspaper column, and then illuminate an audience with a microphone. Extraordinary man, Graham Greene. Why is he important in Liberia? Well, as a young man, he goes there on foot, armed with nothing more than whiskey and Epsom salts, and crosses Liberia in 1936. And this is just such a remote place. The book he generates is called Journey Without Maps. And he goes on a walk. He trudges it and leaves it almost like a trail of biscuit crumbs for those who might come afterwards. Names of villages, descriptions of trails, where the mountains were, what the river crossings were like, that sort of thing. And I was absolutely stimulated. I thought, well, this is marvelous, because this is fabulous. I could go back and do Greene's journey and compare in the 21st century what had become of a land captured in his book in the 1930s, which has all of this history from the 19th century, the 1800s of freed slaves. And I could deal with this wound. I could lance my boil of this terrifying land from when I was a war correspondent. So as ever, as so often in life, it's never one individual thing. It's a combination of factors. That's what drew me there. The plan was, I'll go to Sierra Leone in West Africa. I would cross Sierra Leone, which is quite straightforward. I would do that in the same way that Greene did. He took a train. There was no train when I went there. It had gone in the 1970s. I'll take a bus. Odd enough, went along the same train line, same exact same railway line. You saw the old railway stations and old railway bridges. And I would follow that route, get to where he ended his train journey, and then he walked, and I would walk. I would follow those breadcrumbs across the border from Sierra Leone into remote Liberia, and then see where the journey took me. And just as a little reference, I did this in 2009. Where this journey goes is exactly where the Ebola outbreak starts in 2014, the world's worst ever Ebola outbreak, the one that you will remember, of course. Ebola is associated with the other place that we've talked about with such passion, the Congo, because that's where Ebola was first identified. But it jumps up 2,000 miles away, right on the corner between Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, their land borders deep in the African hinterland. So I'm going to be going through an area which is rich in contemporary conflict history, but also rich in that type of history as well, you know, things that we're going to soon unravel there. So it was a very exciting trip to lay out. And I went there with my rucksack and my boots, and I was thrilled. I was going to walk this time. Unlike Congo, I was going to walk it. It was going to be about 600 kilometers, which isn't an enormous distance, let me be honest. But, you know, we're going through a jungle hinterland, which is tough. You know, 85% humidity, 30 degrees plus, and food and clean water were going to be challenges. And for me, that was, it made it a wonderful, wonderful journey.
This time, we will only have time to talk about some instances along this amazing journey, some encounters, and not about the whole trip, of course, which listeners can read in your book. You started your journey in Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown, and went on from there. And after quite a while, you crossed the Suwa River, if I pronounce it correctly. It's one of the longest and most important rivers in Sierra Leone. And along its shores and on the sandy riverbank, you recognized cavities. And you write that the reason for these cavities was, in large part at least, the explanation for Sierra Leone's troubled modern history. Would you explain that? And how far could you read in these cavities about Sierra Leone's history?
Well, I could answer that very elegant question, long question, with two words, really, and say blood diamonds. A Hollywood film. Some of your listeners might could picture Leonardo DiCaprio putting on a Southern African accent and charging around West Africa, blood diamonds. That was a Hollywood movie that captured the subject. And I was standing on a riverbank, and I was not looking at Hollywood. I was looking at actuality. I'm looking at a riverbank. What's interesting about the diamonds in West Africa is they don't really know, the geologists don't really know where the diamonds emerged in eons past from underneath the Earth's crust, which, you know, there's a geological structure called a kimberlite, which is what geologists look for. They don't really care so much as to finding those because they know Mother Nature has washed those diamonds down rivers centuries after century and eon after eon and millennia after millennia and age after age. So the river gravels, the sand, are rich with diamonds, which would be, if the world was an ordered place in West Africa, a fabulous asset. You could put a fence around it. You could calmly mine it. You could profit from it. There would be polishing going on in Sierra Leone. There would be trading. There would be cutting of diamonds. There'd be all of the processes of the industrial paradigm. But these things don't apply. And this is why Africa, or this part of West Africa, and indeed the Congo, finds, going back to part of our conversation, why do they defy the process, the developed world's assumptions and presumptions, perhaps, about, you know, how economic activity can occur, develop, grow, and then share its benefits with others. Because the diamonds that are scoured out of the gravels of the West African rivers of Sierra Leone, to a lesser extent Liberia, they very rarely profit the locals. They're all smuggled out into the port. They're smuggled out to Antwerp. They're cut there. The processing, the value is added elsewhere. The traders make up their marks elsewhere. The guys digging till their fingernails bleed in the gravels of these rivers. They get the square root of nothing, very little, you know, no job security, no insurance, their health, they're injured one day, that's it. And you quite rarely, it's cavities, it's scoured holes. It's called artisanal mining, which is a euphemism for the most basic raw form of shifting earth. So I was standing on the river and you saw it. You saw a little bit of where Sierra Leone's history came from. Let me just pause and just say Graham Greene in the 1930s, he comes across diamond mining. He deals with traders. He comes across these middlemen who don't pay or drive prices down or and smuggle out of the, you know, he's intrigued by that. I'm speaking to you from South Africa, a country where the Oppenheimer family are so successful, so historically associated through the name De Beers with diamonds. And guess where they operated? They operated in Sierra Leone for years. Nicky Oppenheimer, senior member of the family, once told me he was sent there as a 20-year-old because that was the place where it was the Wild West. It was the tough place to negotiate. So yeah, I was seeing the driver for the history of Sierra Leone, that there is wealth there, but that the wealth can be taken and hijacked, not just by the white outsider. Yes, there have been some white outsiders, but remember, the country has had independence for 55, 60 years, and the leaders who've taken over, there have been coups there, leaders have been taken out and executed. democratic process has been very clunky and bumpy. Those leaders very rarely care for the real people of Sierra Leone. They just want to get their hands on this profit stream, and diamonds represent the profit stream.
Yeah, this reminds me of a meeting you had in Freetown. You talked to John, a senior official responsible for some of the best-funded humanitarian programs, and you talked with him about his work and about the difficulties of development in Sierra Leone. And John told you that, I think he put it like, it feels like a stone being rolled along the riverbed, and it's too heavy to ever float upwards. What was your impression about the chances of development after having traveled through the country?
Well, I think there'll be an echo of what I referred to in my talk about Blood River, which is that the caliber of the people I was meeting, you know, even in these remote areas of acute poverty, the caliber is exactly the same as the caliber that you rub shoulders with through your liberal educated education, you know, background in Germany, and me similarly in Britain, perhaps 20, 30 years before you. Fabulous people, hardworking, talented, lots of honesty, lots of integrity, lots of vision. The problem is they are mired, stuck in a reality where that vision cannot grow for tomorrow because you're just so consumed with surviving today. So the NGO community, who are very, very involved in Sierra Leone and to some extent Liberia, they're almost kind of part of the problem because, you know, they haven't cracked how to develop, how to bring the country forward, to make it grow, because they are equally mired, just as the people of Sierra Leone, in this sort of corrupt reality of a few and the elite stealing and taking. Even though it's been all these years, 2009, I did this journey, so this is 11 years ago. The one thing that I remember acutely was that there had been a fire, an oil fire at the terminal in the capital city of Sierra Leone, Freetown, and people were very badly burned. And obviously for burn injuries, you need analgesia. So they went to the best hospital, the biggest hospital in the country, and they went to the pharmacy and there was no analgesia. It had all been stolen. It had all walked. There were stock lists to say the analgesia was there. There was great inventory to say it should be there. But when you open the cupboard and look on the shelf, there was nothing there. And I just thought, you know, someone dying of a burn injury, which is so, so avoidable. An X-ray machine, one functioning X-ray machine in Sierra Leone for people, you know, for more than a country with more than 10 million people. One X-ray machine. Not that they didn't used to be a lot of X-ray machines. Every provincial town had several X-ray machines, but they weren't maintained and the power went and the units fused and the parts didn't come. So what chance is development? Same chance that I see in the Congo, which is that the people are fabulous and once released, they will fly. But at the moment, they're still trapped on the ground, wings pinned by the corruption and the venality and the theft and this lack of, I mean, even in the last week, the president of Sierra Leone is quoted, you know, widely quoted on the BBC and elsewhere as saying, we cannot be this corrupt. That's his quote. We cannot be this corrupt because if we are, we're doomed. And this is the president of the country, the elected leader, saying this publicly. So in a way, that's a step forward because we're recognizing a problem. And you know, you can't solve a problem until you recognize and appreciate it. So the very fact he's using those words is, from my opinion, good. But we are a long way from the people who helped me being able to reach their full potential.
In your book, you write, in a country like Sierra Leone, corruption feels like sand in an engine. No individual grain is going to do much harm, but taken together over a long time, the grains grind the engine to a halt.
I think that makes the point. I'd forgotten that description of that image, but I'll stand by it. It's a rather good one. If someone else had written it, I'd be pretty impressed. Yeah. It just grind. Because, you know, the little man at the corner, the customs official who says, you can't have your bag back unless you pay me $10, you know, you just roll your eyes and God, another $10. It's, you know, the poor guy, he's a customs official. The government's taken his money. He's got to pay himself some way. You know, he is not an evil person. He is sorting himself out, but that he is a grain of sand and it is self, you know, it is self perpetuating and grains of sand will, you know, they can shift mountains. They will wear it down eventually. So it happens on them. strategic level, the government, it happens on the operational level, to business, and it happens on the tactical level, right on the ground, you and me, you going on holiday to Sierra Leone, you know. Mr. Lawrence, to get your visa at the airport, at the Sierra Leone embassy in Washington, there's a route to get it, but you have to wait for 3 weeks. But if you want it in 2 days, well, there's another route, you know. It breaks my heart. There have to be two routes.
Yeah. Unlike Sierra Leone, Liberia, the next country you went to, is one of the few countries that has not been colonized. After you have been able to compare both countries in terms of development and the like, is it possible at all to draw conclusions about the long-term effects of colonial times?
Well, you make the point, and it's an accurate point, that Liberia has never been colonized. Colonized in terms of made a colony of a foreign power who want to, in some way, impose their structure or their rules. What it has is a slightly different, but very subtly important experience, which is that outsiders have come and controlled Liberia, but they haven't done it in the name of another country. And those outsiders are the ones we referred to in an earlier part of our conversation. The African-American freed slaves from North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Virginia, some of the original colonies of the United States, when they became freed men after this painful process of, you know, the American Civil War and the run-up to the American Civil War and the North being able to encourage slaves in the South to travel north to be free, to become freed men, there was a driver to for them to actually go back to Africa. And that might sound philanthropic. Oh, great, you know, freeing American slaves. Let's go the whole hog and let them go home to Africa. There's also a slightly ugly racist element to that, because what that is saying to some Americans, white Americans, is, oh, my God, there are freed African-American slaves on the streets. Let's get rid of them. Let's come up with a way to sweep them away. Put them on a ship, send them somewhere else. And they were not dropped in their homelands. They were not dropped where their people came from. They were not taken back to the mouth of the Congo River or to Angola or to Mozambique or wherever. They were taken to Liberia, this place, this little capsule of land in West Africa, and dumped. And there they became just as haughty and just as superior as white colonials. And this is what I find interesting. It's this them and us attitude. The presumption of hierarchy, the presumption of betterness. I am better than you because I wear a suit and have a tie and have traveled the oceans and have been overseas. The white man, I've come to Africa. I'm better than you. I have my Bible and my, you know, my reading, writing and arithmetic and my classical education. And it's that presumed superiority that causes problems in both places. So from my perspective, though Liberia has never been colonized as a colony, it has been exploited by the outsider, by the haughty, hierarchical outsider. And that's puts it on the same, frankly, on the same developmental path, which is the few taking from the many, the few lining their own pockets, the many suffering and going back to the thing we talked about in the Congo, which is, you know, what is eventually left? What is eventually left is subsistence and survival, not growth and development. And so both countries have been put on that course, committed on that course because of the reality, that reality, I would say.
You mentioned before that you intended to explore Liberia mainly on foot, by walking, same as Graham Greene did quite a few years before you. What parallels have you found with Greene's trip through Liberia, for example, in relation to the conditions in rural areas? And what differences have you found?
Well, one thing I'd like to make clear to your listeners, to our listeners, is that this was not an exercise in doing Greene's journey exactly as Greene did it. It wasn't some sort of, you know, almost sort of idolatry. He's my idol. I'm going to copy him. For example, he took 24, 25 bearers, people who carried food for him, tins of food in crates on his head, on their heads. They carried him when he got ill and tired. He had a hammock and he was going to be carried and physically carried when he got tired. And he wasn't going to eat local food. He was going to, you know, have his tinned English food from the smart supermarket in Piccadilly in central London, Fortnum and Mason's. He was going to drink his whiskey every night. His tent was going to be put up by somebody else. I don't want to do that. That's not remotely of interest to me. This was not some sort of, you know, praise journey for Graham Greene. I was interested in his observations, and by going to the same places where he went, I would see had it changed. And Greene is a fabulous writer because he cares to get it right. He's a great novelist, but his novels are fabulous because they smell right. They are authentic. And what he would do is he would travel the world and experience it, write a piece of nonfiction and then a piece of fiction. And invariably, his fiction was better than his nonfiction. He went to Mexico and wrote The Lawless Roads, which is nonfiction, and that's pretty bland. But he wrote a fabulous novel called The Power and the Glory from exactly that same trip. But the reason that novel works is that it smells right. So his journey as a writer, wide-eyed, writing everything down, notes, few photographs, was to make to be authentic. And his nonfiction on his journey was good. It's absolutely, you know, reliable. There were a couple of things I found a couple of mistakes, little errors he'd made because I was able to sort of triangulate other sources. One thing we have to also mention, which we have mentioned, is that he did not travel alone without any other Europeans. He took a European with him, mm-hmm. His cousin, a female cousin called Barbara Greene. And she's very interesting to me because she comes with almost like an eye as the innocent abroad. Greene is a bit more cynical. The man, Graham Greene, is wiser man, been to university, fancies himself, man of the world, has already traveled a little bit in Europe. He has, in fact, been to Berlin, where his brother was working as a journalist for the same newspaper I used to work for, the Daily Telegraph. And that brother, Hugh Greene, had already been to Dachau in 1934. So he'd seen what had been created when the National Socialist Party is elected in Germany. And Greene had already touched on that. He'd flown into Berlin under National Socialist Party rules. He'd seen the red banners and he'd seen the kind of mood music. Wise man. But the cousin, Barbara, was a lot more of a novice, an ingenue, traveling for the first time. But frankly, her descriptions are very interesting and very revealing because they are the observations of someone who is an ingenue, who has not seen these things before. So what are the major differences or the major similarities? The striking thing for me were the similarities. What Greene was describing in the 1930s was very much what I was seeing. It had been totally unchanged by 75, 74, 4 or 5 years of development and change. The rural areas of Liberia. I literally, it's like diving off a diving board. When I left the bus, as it were, the road, with internal combustion engines, and I sort of jumped into the forest. It was like diving off a high board. And I found myself splashing through exactly the same water that he did. The same topography, the same style of living, the same villages, the huts, how people scrabbled for food in the jungle. They would lay out fields, interestingly for me, I didn't know this, of rice, not Asian rice with paddy fields, but an African rice. And Greene described that and how hard it was. I was witnessing it with my own eyes. He also described the hazards of sleeping in a village hut in Liberia, which are basically that bush rats. These are very substantial animals, very substantial animals, the size of a large rabbit, scurry through these houses in the roofs, in the thatched roofs, in the palm trees. And you have to be slightly wary of this because they carry disease. Lassa fever is endemic in that area, and that's carried by rats and spread in their, and if you'll excuse this, the rather rough detail, it's spread in their urine. And as they urinate, they're spreading a pathogen. They're spreading a nasty thing. And Greene was describing it. The first night I was in a hut, there are these rats the size of rabbits bouncing around. I mean, thumping is extraordinary. And the villagers have Lassa fever, not very surprisingly, in 2009. As they had in the 1930s. I was very interested that the power of the mission stations, the religious Christian groups that had reached out into the bush, Greene made his way from one mission station to another because they were kind of places where you could be sure to get a good night's sleep and to, you know, make some sort of contact. I went to found the same mission, you know, mission stations clinging on. I found that element of faith. But the thing that was most interesting were the observations that Green made about how society in the forest is glued together. And it was highly sophisticated and highly natural and highly with lots of parallels with Europe. And what I mean is we're talking about an animist society, pre-Christian society, who made sense of their existence by worshipping the spirits of the jungle in exactly the same way that Europeans did, pagan Europeans did before Christianity arrived. And Green was very attuned to this. It's very good at observing this. And as I went, I was thinking, you know, I mustn't look for it. You know, I'm not expecting it to be there. But if it is, I must acknowledge it. But it must surely, after 80 years, have moved on. But no, I found society glued together by the worship of traditional leaders and traditional experts who could commune with the spirits. And they did this in a very powerful way. They did this through an individual, or maybe one or two figures in the village. They were humans, but they would don masks. And once the mask was on and the costume, they stopped being human and they became the point of contact with the spirit world of those who've gone before, your ancestors, and those who might come in the future, those who will guide you. And in Liberia, they have a very, very strong word for these figures. They are known in every village as the devil. And of course, in the Christian language, devil is a very dark and sinister thing. And yes, it can appear dark and sinister. But Green himself, who saw devils moving in the society and influencing these villages and talking, they just comes up in conversation all the time. What does the devil say about it? You know, how do you get your medicine? The devil will tell us. Where do you hunt? The devil will tell us. How do you get your education? The devil teaches the kids. The devil has bush school. They go out to the school. I mean, in the bush. It's extraordinary. And Green was able to cut through this and say, hold on, the devils aren't this negative sort of witch doctor thing. They're something much more powerful. They are this sort of unifying force, but they do use that word devil and that name devil. And that makes it very powerful. That's why the book I wrote is called Chasing the Devil, because we have a number of chases going on to explore this type of devilry and also the devil of war, the devil of developmental problems and all of the corruption and the negative aspects, but also, you know, there is this other element, which is that society in the rural hinterland of Sierra Leone and Liberia both held together by ancestor worship through a figure in the community known as the devil. And in the 1930s, he was alive and well. And in 2009, very alive and very well.
In many places, ancient traditions to some extent are still being practiced, but maybe the meaning and the relevance has changed in the past years and decades. Did you get a feeling for the status and the meaning, for example, specifically the devil dance and the belief surrounding it, still has today? In your book, for example, you write about a secret bush societies. And how far is that important in contemporary life for these people?
I believe, having spent a few weeks, 5 weeks, walking through the bush of Liberia, that it is the most important social, societal linkage. It defeats Christian worship, monotheism. It defeats Western education. It defeats economic commerce. It is the thing that matters. You can't do commerce unless it's signed off. You can't let a chapel be built from missionaries unless the devil signs off. You can't do healthcare and deal with Ebola unless the devil signs off. It is absolutely key today to understanding how the society works out in the bush. And that might sound a bit weird and a bit strange and a bit retrograde to think about, you know, masked figures and that sort of thing. But just pause for a second and think, you know, how does a society survive in the jungle? They do need to pass on knowledge about trapping. When do animals trap? What's the season for this animal? If I do get sick, what leaves do I eat? What muti is there? What medicine might there be? And all of this is stored, you know, in this body of knowledge and body of belief. And I was convinced it was extraordinarily powerful. And, you know, FGM, female genital mutilation, a subject that comes up in the Western world when occasionally we have experience of it might be happening within a refugee community that has arrived in Berlin or London, say. That is absolutely common in the female version of the devil schools. And it's I met some extraordinarily sophisticated, advanced, developed, university-educated women in Sierra Leone and Liberia. And when I mentioned this, they just said, well, of course you've got to accept FGM. Of course. And I just went, well, that's just a retrograde step. So, no. It's what defines us. It's what gives us, brings us together. It's what glues us. Once you've done that, we know what type of person you are. You're one of us. And if you don't do it, you're not one of us. Therefore, you're an outlier. And you're quite right to say that traditional beliefs are very strong in all over the world, whether it's shamans up in the Andes, or religious figures in the dervishes in the Middle East, or further east, spiritual figures walking the byways of the Himalayas as they pray their way from one side of the mountain range to the other. But in West Africa, in this place, these traditional beliefs are alive and well and fundamental to society. And without understanding them, I don't think you can really grasp that place.
Do you feel these beliefs and traditions are what makes these societies work and what makes them strong as a social network internally? Or do you feel they also pose a threat and need to some extent need to be overcome in order for these societies to move on and to develop, whatever we mean if we talk about development?
What I think they're very good at is survival. What they've worked out is how to subsist in the jungle forest situation. And these rules and codes do not allow for individual success. Or you might call it in English the tall poppy syndrome. If a tall poppy rises above the rest of the poppies, you cut the head of that poppy off so that the poppy field remains at the same level. That means the poppies will always be this high. You'll never have a sunflower. You'll never have one reaching for the sky. And I believe that explains why development doesn't happen in this part of the world, because the tall poppy syndrome is so acute. You must do what we say. You must do what this, you must be God-fearing. You must fear the devil. Do what the devil says. If you don't, they're coming for you. And there have been cases of them coming for you. I mean, Charles Taylor employed "they're coming for you" as a fear tactic when he was running his evil regime. It's very real and very violent. And it's designed for subsistence. It's not designed for growth. It's designed for the greatest achievement of humanity in that part of the world, which is just getting on, surviving with Lassa fever and hunger and dirty water and all of the rest of the other things. And it works very well for survival. It just doesn't work very well for growth and the development. And the last part of your question was about development. I think we at the West, we kind of need to somehow just take out of our eye this presumption that everyone wants to develop economically, everyone wants to advance, because it's not necessarily the case in the rest of the world. That in a classic Ricardian, Keynesian, Adam Smith economic development is the paradigm, because in this part of the world, that's certainly not the paradigm. The paradigm is survival, and how you survive, you respect your ancestors. How do you talk to them? Through the devil. That's how it's done. Listen to what the devil says. Never have your own opinion, and never grow taller than the rest of the poppies, or else.
These places that we talked about and that you visited, they are fascinating. They are rough. They can be dangerous. You have also mentioned that some minutes ago in the beginning of our conversation. And you also mentioned that some of your colleagues were killed in these places. Shortly before you started your journey, you went to visit an ambush site where specifically two of your friends had been killed. Would you mind briefly talking about their story? What had happened there?
As I mentioned, the part of this reason to do this trip was a catharsis, was to deal with the sense of being overwhelmed. Back working as a reporter, and never was I more overwhelmed than when in May of 2000, when we were in Sierra Leone, and I was sent with some old colleagues I've known for 10 years in Bosnia and Kosovo, etc. We all turned up, and we did what we always do, which is, everyone chats with themselves, and where are you going? And I go here, there, and everywhere. And two guys I knew very, very well set off, and I didn't know exactly where they were going that morning. I didn't track them. I was doing my own thing. And they went to a place called Rogbury Junction, and they turned right down a little road to a place called Lunsa. It's a tar road. The driver of their vehicle said, "This is too dangerous. This is just too dangerous." But they spoke to some locals. The locals said, we'll take you. So the driver got out. My friend drove the lead car. Second friend drove the back car. And a third friend of mine was sitting in the back. He was a photographer. And it gets pretty rough at this point, I have to tell you, because they went down this road. They made a right. They made a left. They were just on this tar road. And as the road curved, bam, 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 they were in a full-on ambush. Kalashnikov rounds through the front windscreen. The driver, American guy called Kurt Schork, was killed instantaneously. He was at Oxford with Bill Clinton. So his funeral was attended by a U.S. president. So Kurt Schork was no fool, and he was well-connected. He was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, very well-respected. Miguel Moreno was he's a Spanish, he's a Catalan, actually, proud Catalan, from Barcelona, was the driver in the vehicle at the back. He was also killed because the ambush guys went for the guys in the driving seat. And the photographer in the back seat of this chaotic situation with bits of glass and blood and bullets and chaos and other people, the locals who had said it was safe, are now jumping out of the vehicle and it was chaos. Yanis, he was a Greek, Yanis Barakis, I say was, because sadly he passed away from cancer just last year. Yanis managed to get out, and then it began this most horrific sort of Hollywood-style hiding where he didn't know what was going on. He didn't know if his friend had been killed, in chaos, but he was hiding in the jungle, in the bush, under the leaves, under the branches, and the gunmen were coming for him, and they were looking, and they walked, and he had to be silent in a... And it's the most horrific thing, insects crawling up his nostrils, sweat in his eyes, fear in his heart, adrenaline pumping, and didn't know what was going on. And these guys were looking for him, and they would have murdered him had they found him. And they came within a few meters, scrunch, scrunch, scrunch. I mean, just pause, and would you move your hand to swat that insect in your eye? The fear, the disorientation. You know, these guys knew Bosnia, but they didn't know Sierra Leone. They knew Kosovo, but they didn't know the Lunsata Rugbury Junction Road. I mean, it's horrific. It's just a totally alien environment. And then there was some shooting in the distance when some other soldiers who were opposed to the ambush guys came along, and they fired bullets everywhere, and the ambush guys run away. But then the bullets are coming into the trees, and Yanis is almost hit by the guys who are meant to be rescuing him, and it's chaos, and bits of tree are falling on him, and his friend's blood is on his shirt. And then he waits. He does what any sensible person, he just buries his head in the ground and just waits till the chaos is finished. And then when eventually the peace rains and there's some sort of quiet, he goes back onto the road, and there's the car destroyed, and no one else, even the bodies have gone. He doesn't know what's happened. So he doesn't know he's disorientated, and he takes a photograph of himself. He said to me later, he said, I'm a photographer. What do? I don't write a will. I take a photograph. So he took an amazing selfie, held his arm up, and he shared that photograph, which I was allowed to use in my book. And if you look at that, you'll never see a man whose eyes are more, his pupils are more dilated. He was terrified, disorientated. So Yanis gave a voice to that horrific thing. We were in Freetown. We heard that afternoon that some journalists had been killed. Initially, it was three, then one, then two. We didn't know who it was. Everyone was sort of looking at each other going, who is it? Was it you? Because the moment someone comes around the corner, you know they're, so it can't be them. And the list was getting ticked off until it became triangulated down to Miguel and to Kurt. And these were, as I say, colleagues and friends, people you'd been through a lot with, and they'd just gone down the wrong road. Could have been me, could have been my road. It wasn't. And that tells you a little bit, it's a brush with mortality. It's a brush with futility. Is journalism really worth your life? What are the risks? So, doing this journey, this whole Sierra Leone Liberia trip in 2009, in part was kind of dealing with that and putting that to bed, reminding myself that I didn't want my West African image to be of gunmen with Kalashnikovs. I wanted to meet real people. And we haven't actually mentioned my hero of my trip, Johnson Boy, if I may. If it's okay with you.
Yes, please.
In the Congo, I had different people who helped me on my trip. But Johnson basically started on that border with Liberia, and he walked with me for 35 days. And this was a guy who'd never walked with a white guy through Africa a day in his life. It was just a completely novel experience. And he was amazing at helping me, at being just a decent human, just getting on with people, arriving in villages, being courteous, being polite, being discreet, being forceful when he needed to be, being firm when he needed to be, being discreet when he needed to be. So I wanted my memory of West Africa to be owned by someone like Johnson Boy, this wonderful guide. I didn't want it to be owned by thugs with Kalashnikovs. And frankly, too many of us read about West Africa and our images are dominated by the corrupt few, the Charles Taylor, the thugs, the Prince Yomi Johnson, the leader of the RUF, the Congolese dictator. And I just get so angry with that, because the reality is those people don't reflect the human quality in this part of the world. And I wanted to wrestle it back, say, no, you with the guns, you don't keep this. You do not hold a monopoly on representing what your poem is about. I'm going to find others. And in my case, I found Johnson, and he was a fabulous guide. And my book is as much dedicated to him as it is to anybody.
Yeah, and I believe in the British edition of the book, the subtitle of the book is The Search for Africa's Fighting Spirit. The way you talk about him, I would like to think that it partly refers indeed to people like him, right?
I think you're right. I mean, it's a little word play, fighting spirit. Yes, there's a war there, but also just the fight, just the pluck to survive. And yeah. Johnson was fabulous. You know, he had had a bad war, been driven out of his village. He'd seen some people killed in his village. He'd been a refugee. He'd come back. He had skills. He had language. He used to guide refugees back to their villages. And I saw fighting spirit from him. And, it's a bit of a word play. And I hope the reader can make their own mind up as to what type of fighting spirit they recognize.
So did this trip do for you what you hoped it would do for you?
Yes. The Congo trip, magnificent experience that it was, life-changing experience that it was, as we discussed, a very quick one, very abbreviated. I was rushing. I was scared. I was terrified. I was told you couldn't hang here. You've got to move on a motorbike. You can't hang. What I loved about the Liberian trip was it went at the pace of something that everyone listening to this can recognize. It went at walking pace. You get tired, you sleep. You get hungry, you stop and eat. You get thirsty, you draw water from a stream. You get blistered, you wait till your blisters heal. You get hot, you wait till the shade comes. It was a beautiful walk from that experience. It was a walk. I learned how to sleep by the side of the road. I learned how to deal with, insects that you don't normally come across. I learned how to recognize what's important in life in this part of the world, which goes back to the first part of our conversation, surviving. If you're ill, what do you do? There's no doctor. There's no medic. There's no ambulance you call. So you do call the devil. You want to be educated. You want to learn stuff. There's no teacher. There's no headmaster. There's no curriculum. So you do call the devil. You want to learn how to trap animals. I have an awful admission to make. I ate pangolin in Liberia. I ate pangolin because it was the only form of protein. And pangolin's a rare and beautiful animal. It gets referred to in our newspapers as part of smuggling. But I ate it because it was a food source. I ate bushmeat. And you want to know why Ebola breaks out in West Africa? It's because there is no other protein source than bats that might be living in that tree. And it just so happens that the bat carries a pathogen. So I got a sense of life. I got a sense of what's important. And I keep, as a little bit, we mentioned when we were talking about the Congo, just kept in my mind referring to how Britain used to be, how Europe used to be, how similar, how frankly identical these places were. And our presumption that our modern world is in some way inexorable or inevitable or natural. No, the natural thing is survival, frankly. That's the purest human endeavor. Survival. If you're lucky enough to be able to go beyond that and grow and develop, then well done. Marvelous. But don't ever presume that everyone on the planet is at that same stage. And that's probably my most fundamental lesson that I took from the trip.
Tim, this was another really, really fascinating conversation for me. And it is indeed also a really fascinating read, Chasing the Devil. That's what the book is called. And I really highly recommend it. Even after listening to this conversation, because of course the book offers so much more. And I thank you very much for your time once again, Tim. Thank you.
I'm delighted. It's always a great pleasure to talk to someone who is so who gets the book so well. And I'm delighted to be able to reach through you to a wonderful audience who are also engaged and know that travel is, frankly, the most important human learning process in the world. It's only through travel that we do get out of our comfort zone and learn. And we're all wanderers at heart. Everyone needs to remember that. We are all wanderers at heart.
Nice. Thank you. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.